Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello, it's Tom Dark, not a stab here. Welcome to part two of our Nomad Deep Dive, with more to follow over the next few weeks. Without further ado, let's get back to the action as we delve into chapters one and two. Bosch.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With his stupid Ewok head.
Blah blah on him, Nolsey.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
The total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker.
Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay. Dale Winton. Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
And we're on to chapter one, Cold Opening, which is a brilliant name for a chapter for so many reasons. The main one being that it's a bastardization of Cold Open. That's the TV term,
yeah, of course,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than opening.
So
he's anglicized. He's anglicized an American turn. Cold Open is obviously where you open the episode straight into a scene and you save the credits for later. The other thing is that the only reason you do a Cold Open is for impact. So by announcing that it's a Cold Opening before you do it, you've ruined the point immediately.
And also, we've had so much prologue and everything before this as well. Arguably, it isn't even a Cold Open.
No, exactly. We've been through about 15 title pages. And so he goes, 4 minutes, 4 minutes to save East Anglia. I thought, firstly, these stakes are very much medium, aren't they?
It's the worst episode of 24 ever, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Could have been the world. And I mean, I think we all knew as we read this that East Anglia was in no peril and this is another literary device of Alan's. So he claims he's got 240 seconds. He looks at his watch and in slow motion, he mouths the word motherfucker.
Brackets motherfucker.
I would say as well, whenever we, over the last few weeks, whenever we've posted on our socials about the fact we're covering Nomad, I think that seems to be the most commonly used comment is just motherfucker. It's definitely a favourite.
Let's hear it from Alan now.
I look at my watch and in slow motion, I mouth the word motherfucker.
Very nice. So yeah, he claiming he has to get to the top of a hill to stop some kind of nuclear meltdown, I think. And there's 10 metres to go with a sixth of a second remaining. Well, we know that can't be true because he would never clear that distance in that time.
Yeah.
And then, yes, he's done it. He's done it. East Anglia is saved. And then he realises he's celebrating, jumping up and down, arms aloft like Rambo on the steps of Philadelphia Town Hall.
Yeah. That's a mistake, isn't it, surely?
Yes.
Is it a mistake?
No.
Is it Philadelphia Town Hall? Well, it's Philadelphia. Well,
I think the joke there is that he's describing it as a town hall, as if you have town halls in America. Also, yeah. Philadelphia is a city, right. not a town. Yeah. I mean, I also imagine there's probably something that we've missed, where actually that building is a very famous building with its own kind of recognizable name. It's like calling the White House, you know, the big president's house. It's not until the next paragraph that we realize, in reality, of course, no lives were at risk.
What a surprise.
Yeah. Even if they had been, he could have done little or nothing to save them. So what gived? So yeah, he's describing a motivational technique,
a stunningly effective motivational technique,
a technique he pioneered in primary school. Climb to the top of this rope or granddad kills himself, catch the ball 3 times in a row or you contract herpes. And I thought, is this a technique or is that OCD,
or is it just enough attempts to drum up some kind of tension, obviously at the beginning of the book, and yeah, it hasn't worked.
Very much that, yes.
Also, it's only about 100 words. Like, it's not even that long. Like, the tension that he's built up for this scene getting to the top of the hill is not... It barely fills 2 pages.
And I like the fact that he strings it out, like by segments of this, second by second, because yeah. obviously he can't actually obtain the motivational technique that he's trying to set.
Half a second. Yeah. Yeah. A quarter of a second.
Yeah. I think the biggest kind of... narrative literary mess is coming up, where he says I'm chipping away at the walk, and God Christ, it needs chipping away at. The footsteps of my father walk is 160 miles long. Now at this point, he hasn't explained that he's going on a walk. He hasn't named it as the footsteps of my father walk.
Yeah.
He's literally just thrown it in as if we already know exactly what he's doing.
That's a really good point.
Do you think that's intentional?
I think there are a number of things littered throughout the book that could be intentional or could be sloppy, safe in the knowledge that Alan would be sloppy, so it's okay to be sloppy.
It's funny, I hadn't really thought about that, because obviously I've read the book quite a few times, so something like that, I'm like, yeah, I know that. But
it's just that's not in and of itself particularly funny. It doesn't really add anything. So kind of to your point, is it an error? Or is it just it's an error that can be kind of written off because Alan would have made that mistake?
I think it's an error in the APU. It's a consistent Alan-esque style of writing, isn't
it? Kind of like he's been talking for 2 chapters and he's like, oh, by the way, I'm going on this big walk.
just throw that out there.
Yeah. Also, at this point, it's 160 miles long, but will it be by the end? Stay tuned.
He ends the chapter by saying, I'm Alan Partridge. I'm under a little pressure, but I'm focused and happy. And I thought that's quite a telling line about his relationship with pressure, because we know it's not great. Yeah. He buckles. Yeah.
There's also a line that I will be using as well whenever I want to kind of give myself a little pep, and that is, I feel more Dimbleby than ever.
So on to chapter 2, what has driven me to walk, driven in italics, Alan's italics. I'm sure he's very happy with himself about that little play on words. It opens with a quote, will they be taking me for lunch? I've forgotten my toothpicks, which indicates that Alan can't eat without getting food stuck in his teeth. He's basically replying to Lynn. First mention of Lynn here. Well, I say mention of Lynn. He obviously refers to her as my assistant. Presumably, that's to stop her getting ideas above her station and to remind her that she's replaceable. That's why he never actually says
that. And just to put her down, basically. Any opportunity to put her down.
So we learn that he is going to what he believes is an invitation to pitch ideas at the BBC.
And we know that he must be on a high, because obviously he's letting his assistant drive, which he would never do.
Yeah.
So he's obviously very excited, very buoyed about the fact that he's been invited to the BBC.
Is that because he wants to be focused on the BBC meeting and just...
To be honest, when he said that, I was very surprised that even under such circumstances that Lynn would be allowed to drive. But this is where we are.
Yep. Although he does sometimes like Lynn to just come and pick him up from situations.
True.
It certainly doesn't preclude him from criticising her driving. He says, today she can adjust the steering column and even angle the wing mirrors if she likes, which I thought that's a safety must.
I was
going to
say, absolutely. Yeah, that's not a privilege. That's just ensuring your safety and everyone in the car.
Do you think on lesser days she's not allowed to move his settings if she has to crane to see if there's a car behind her? She can't fiddle with the 3 pre-programmed seating positions, though, which he's named Cruise, Rally and Service Station Kip, SSK.
I thought they were genuinely brilliant as well. If I ever own a car which allows you to have electronic seat settings,
I would definitely
calibrate them along these lines, because they sound like the perfect thing that you would need as far as seat settings go.
So this meeting at the BBC, I think, is designed to be a neat way of sparking the Hares conversation in readers' minds and bringing us back to his previous tangles with the BBC. He says his task is to pitch some ideas at commissioners who responded to his assistant's mail drop by calling him in to hear more. Now, I mean, I'd love to read the mail drop.
Yeah.
What is Lynn writing to get him invited to this thing? And I mean, is she literally just cold calling old contacts at the BBC? Is that's basically what he's describing, isn't he?
I'd imagine so, yeah.
So he says, it's an unexpected invitation, but Yew Tree has been a knight of the long knives for broadcasters of a certain age and left a hole in the roster of graying presenters that not even that woman who sued Countryfile could fill. So that's a reference to Miriam O'Reilly, who sued the BBC for sexism and ageism. And she won the ageism case in January 2011, though she did not win the sexism case.
I was going to say, I was quite pleased when first reading this book, the fact that they do address Yew Tree kind of head on within the second chapter, because I think it would be quite weird to kind of not reference that when so much is about Alan and the sort of broadcasters that he mentions. And I just think it's quite a nice bit of phrasing that it's been a night of the long knives.
Yeah, and it's absolutely it's kind of foreshadowing for the premise of this time as well. You know, in the,
yeah.
they needed someone of his type, and there weren't a huge amount of options to choose from. Yeah.
And John Baskell had died.
Hashtag John gone.
John Baskell.
The John Baskell Foundation.
Broadly good.
So they arrive at the BBC. Alan shouts, "Stop the car!" Has no faith in Lynn to do it otherwise. My assistant slams on the brakes. Her one and only method of braking. In all honesty, you can totally imagine that, can't you?
She really doesn't have gentle feet.
And then he spots across the road from Broadcasting House, about to enter the Langham Hotel, Julia Bradbury. So this is post Mid-Morning Matters series 2, isn't it? So his feelings for Julia are well known.
There's a footnote here, which is in the book, that doesn't appear in the audio for the Langham Hotel. Don't know why it's not in the audiobook, because I quite like it. The footnote reads, "Never stayed there myself. It's always seemed a bit jazz hands with its over-elaborate cream teas and the cost of G&Ts comfortably in the double figures."
Langham Hotel.
All true, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to say, Langham Hotel is real, isn't it?
It's literally across the road from BBC, so that is all grounded in fact.
Fact.
He describes Julia Bradbury as having sent him a lovely message when he posted her a copy of his last book, I, Partridge, then texted her to make sure it arrived, and she texts him saying, "Got your book, thanks."
A glowing review.
And he notices that she's with short-haired presenter Claire Balding and a well-oiled gentleman. All three are in high spirits, and immediately he starts to try and ingratiate himself with this crowd.
These are scenes where obviously you can picture what's happening, but I really would like to see this played out in a visual form, where essentially Alan is trying to talk to people who are essentially just ignoring him, him just trying to coerce himself into the conversation
whilst also blaming traffic and sort of anything else for the fact that they're not listening to him.
Oh yeah, I love that. I think that's a consistent theme throughout the book, is Alan having digs at London, isn't there? So traffic that clogs up every road in the city. People always tell you the streets are paved with gold in London. They don't say you'll need to lift a bus out of the way to get at it.
They're having a chat, Julia, Claire Balding and the well-oiled gentleman, about the differences between BBC and Channel 4. He tries to chip in with his contribution, which I think is very funny, but obviously not what they were talking about.
It's a good observation, though.
It's not bad, yeah. Channel 4 shows start with a very British, and the BBC shows start with the Great British. Two very different approaches to British TV.
Do you have the list of examples?
I do, and they're all real. Coup, brothel, sex scandal and UFO hoax on Channel 4's side.
So they're all very British.
And then Menu, Bake Off, Railway Journeys and Sewing Bee.
They're all Great British.
Also a very nice subtle dig at sort of homogenous programming at both channels, isn't it?
Yes, basically. Absolutely.
That's really good. The conversation continues and they're talking about the Rambling gig on Radio 4 that one of them's got, and he says, "Why have I never heard of it?" And then he realises, because he doesn't listen to Radio 4, which made me think, what does he listen to? Presumably only North Norfolk Digital, maybe a smattering of Radio 2.
Oh, LBC, I reckon. I think he's all over LBC. I think Alan would love a gig on LBC.
I could imagine him only ever listening to North Norfolk Digital and just getting annoyed at all the other presenters and what they're doing.
Yeah, it's probably that.
But I like the idea as well that Alan has this rule. No, I don't listen to Radio 4. Like, regardless, he just won't listen.
More slamming of homogenous programming when he says that Julia Bradbury's done Wainwright's walks, railways walks, canal walks, Icelandic walks. Harvey's got her walking all the way to the bank, to which Alan says, "Who commissioned that? Let me guess, Channel 4. No, I just mean she's doing well financially.
But he would watch that as well.
And I think most of those Bradbury programs are real as well.
I've not heard of any of them, but it made me realise that I just don't watch a lot of TV, to be honest.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard of many of these apart from the obvious things like Bake Off.
I've got more on Bradbury's walks later.
Okay, fine. Stay tuned. That is a real cliffhanger, listeners.
Don't miss it.
Always
he'll be in about 6 weeks as well.
Yeah.
It becomes apparent from this exchange that basically they gave him the idea for Nomad. This wasn't an original idea of Alan's at all. It's just something he overheard from better broadcasters. Doesn't he suggest a few as well? He says he could go east to west across England's narrowest point, the Beltline of Britain, or just a rectangle around the Midlands. I call that one the Guts of Albion. And then Harvey Kennedy, who's the well-oiled gentleman in this conversation, says, it helps if it has some historical or personal significance, you know, literally writing this book for Alan at this point. he says, he pats my shoulder as if to say, I like you, Alan, very much. It's another one of those, his pats seem to suggest, you know, yeah, his eyes seem to say.
That's quite consistent throughout the book, I think, that as if to say, and it's obviously the opposite, he's just twisting it.
Who do you think would play Harvey Kennedy in a TV adaptation of Nomad? I've got my pick. The actor David Haig, who you may know from The Thin Blue Line and The Thick of It.
That's a great shout.
Yeah.
I just nailed that then, basically?
Yeah, I mean, we could go around, but I'd be happy to cast him.
Yep, I'd take that. David Suchet, perhaps.
Good one. Yeah, that was good. Like that.
And I've got an absolute brain fart on the name of the guy who's the lead in The King's Speech.
Colin Firth? Colin,
no. Yes.
Oh. Yeah.
I said no. I mean yes. Yeah.
Okay. And also, that's not who I was thinking of.
Oh, you mean the speech therapist.
Jeffrey yes. Rush?
Yeah, Jeffrey
no,
Rush.
No, I don't mean him.
You mean David Thewlis?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, David Thewlis would be
Toby
good.
Jones?
No.
He'd be good.
He would be good, but he's not who I'm thinking of.
Okay, fine.
Don't worry.
I give up with this game where there's almost no clues.
If anyone knows that's who I'm really great. If anyone knows who I'm thinking of, thepartridgepod@gmail.com, please do tell me. So Alan's fully razzed.
Yeah, he's had to go into the bog though to razz himself up.
Oh, can I just say as well, I did enjoy that he has the line, quick final glance at Bradbury before he
and a withering put down of all of the younger people in fisherman's woolly hats pitching ideas at the BBC. One man wearing a fisherman's woolly hat is on a raised stage saying something about a fashion programme for the discerning mature gent, adding that it's more George Clooney than George Lazenby. Everyone laughs, but I once shared a paella with George Lazenby and don't.
Yeah, I want way more of that story. I'd love to hear about the paella fiasco, but we'll never know.
So he blames Lynn because he thought it was a one-on-one meeting and it turns out it's an open day.
I'll also never get bored of hearing Alan slag off young people as well. Like, I'll never get bored of it.
Young people and London.
Yes, yeah. Always slag off young people in London.
This is like when my neighbour had a go at me and told me I was living a hipster lifestyle because I once had a barbecue.
How dare you?
Bloody hipsters.
Although it's interesting to note that the idea of Alan going to the BBC on what he thinks is an invitation to pitch ideas but turns out to be an open day was actually one of the alternate openings discussed for Alpha Papa. So if you listen to the DVD commentary of Alpha Papa, the Gibbons and Steve Coogan talk about the different ways they were planning to open Alpha Papa. And one of the ideas was back at the BBC, Alan thinking he's going to pitch an idea or ideas from his portfolio, and then it turns out it's an open day.
Yeah, Neil Gibbons actually, in an interview with Esquire back in 2013, said exactly on this point, in the original script, at the start of the film, Alan is invited to the BBC to pitch some ideas. He's delighted and prepares massively, but when he gets there, he walks into a massive room with hundreds of people in it who've all been invited. He misread the invitation, it was just an open day. He then drowns in front of all these cool, relevant Hoxton types.
Oh, so he actually does get involved in the open day, he doesn't just sort of storm out in the original
idea. Yeah, looks like he would, well, just kind of spaffed it.
Because that's a crucial point in the book, is that he says, check your eyes, woman, to him. It's an open day. It's clearly an open day. Now, from that jumping off point, you would think that he's already at the BBC with programme ideas. He might as well have a bloody good go at it. But the next paragraph opens, not to worry. And with that, we bob out of the door and head back to Norfolk. Yeah. I drive. So Lynn's driving privileges have been revoked as well.
I would quite like to have seen that, Alan, sort of going into pitch ideas. Yeah. But would it have been a little bit... I mean, the reason that the Gibbons say that they didn't go with that as an idea... But Alpha Papa was because the BBC is too synonymous with Alan. So I don't think they were quite ready to revisit Alan at the BBC back then before, obviously, they went on to do this.
I guess
time.
They wanted it to be more of a departure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they go on to say that they always try to subvert what they do with Alan. So if they say in the commentary, if a fan could come up with the idea, they bin it off. So they always want to keep people guessing, right, and do something different rather than what people expect of Alan, which I think is good because it creates, you know, it refreshes the character.
I also think if they opened the film with Alan at the BBC and then the rest of the film didn't involve the BBC, people might feel a bit shortchanged.
I also think you've got the BBC card to play, and that is a massive card. Don't just throw it away with him being there and then just walking out.
That's such like the first 2 minutes of the film.
That's a big thing.
So they're on their way back to Norfolk. He says, well, the only people who wear fisherman's hats are the trawlermen at Brancaster, all the while discussing potential competition ideas for Mid-Morning Matters, the digital radio show that keeps me both happy and fulfilled and content. That is a great line for so many reasons. Obviously, he's subtly trying to undermine the idea that
it doesn't keep him any
of those things, but also he says it keeps him both, and then he names three things, which is another bit of a fuck up there. But later that night, he lies awake and realizes that I, Alan Partridge, am in the grip of a grump. He does love to downplay his anxiety and depression, doesn't he? Clinically fed up, etc. He tries to sort of diminish the idea that he's having a real problem.
But Adam, it's nothing to do with the absence of telework. It's not. He couldn't give a shit about that.
Much like his references to Noel Edmonds, I think later in this book.
Save it.
But yeah, it's that perspective flip thing where you know the reality is the opposite of what he's writing.
He's now trying to set up the premise for this book, basically saying that there's something wrong. He's been sleepwalking. He's an autopilot. You know what's gone wrong. He also said one of his examples of his mind lapses is that he parked in a standard space instead of the disabled bay, completely forgetting that his assistant is in the car and carries her blue badge with her. And I thought, do we know what Lynn's disability is?
No. Just a quick note. Alan says that he's been sleepwalking. Obviously, he doesn't mean literally. And then there's a really great footnote that goes into detail about Alan's skepticism when it comes to sleepwalking. I'll read a bit of it now. No, the whole thing is a smokescreen, a get-out-of-jail-free card, and it just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. Raided the fridge when you're supposed to be on a diet, sleepwalking. Took a hammer to a much-loved CD collection, sleepwalking. Found in the spare room with your colleague Philip after your husband had to let him stay over because he's had two glasses of wine and was over the limit, even though they were only small glasses and he was clearly fine to drive, sleepwalking. Come off it, Carol.
So she's done all three of those things, and it's obviously another affair, isn't it? So
yeah.
Is this the first time that we get a hint that it wasn't just the narcissistic sports pimp? That
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 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 I think
good
so.
Point. And then a quick question to the group. Have you got any sleepwalking stories?
I don't personally. I've never sleepwalked as far as I'm aware.
No, me either.
I haven't sleepwalked.
Are you sure about that, Nick?
Yes.
What about that one time you urinated in the corner of your bedroom?
I'd forgotten about that.
Are you claiming you were fully awake and conscious when that happened?
I think that's not sleepwalking. That's
so you were awake.
That's booze rambling.
Nick's booze rambles.
He's been
Would read.
Yeah. He spent a lot of time rambling in beer gardens.
Yeah, one minute you're enjoying half a pint of cider, the next thing you know, you're basically taking a waz in the corner of your bedroom.
So Adam, no. Tom, no. Nick, yes.
Nick, Dave, Clifton, older, yes.
Apparently, apparently I've done it once.
What, piss in the corner of your bedroom? We've all done it, mate.
No, just you, mate.
No, that was more than once. Apparently, when I was a kid, I just sleepwalked into my mum and dad's bedroom and demanded Marmite on toast.
Really?
In the middle of the night, yeah.
How old were you? Never done it again. 18?
Classic stab.
Yeah, I mean, I do love Marmite and...
Mummy.
Mum. Love you, Mum.
So, Alan tries to get to the bottom of his listlessness. He makes a list of possible causes, and yet even with this list, I remain listless. Is that even possible, to have a list and still be listless? Either way, it bugs the bleeding shit out of me. There's then... A footnote about bleeding shit, explaining it's merely a turn of phrase. Blood on toilet paper is a common sign of bowel cancer when I check each sheet diligently, aware that if there are dots of red, it's generally nothing more than a rectal fissure. I do not have bowel cancer or hemorrhoids. He loves a bum chat, doesn't he?
He does love bum chat.
Any script, excuse. Script.
Yeah, so unnecessary, but very detailed.
Very anally fixated.
Yeah, another inaccurate pluralisation. He's very much in the doldrums, the doldra. And then he goes on to describing Denton Abbey, his Norwich home, as both massive and brilliant.
I love that.
Yeah, the way a kid would describe their house.
The kind of house you drive past and say, shit, who lives there?
He gets irked at this point by Dom Littlewood, primetime BBC One presenter.
I mean, yeah, I'm kind of with him on this, to be fair.
Because Dom's throwing away banknotes and saying you're wasting like pound after pound.
Yeah.
I agree with Alan as well. It's lazy and wrong.
Yeah, and the way he describes Dom Littlewood, a presenter who looks and sounds like he won his primetime BBC One presenting job in a raffle brackets and probably did.
Yeah, agree.
But Dom Littlewood, Littlewood is one of those like classic people, a bit like, what's her name, Alison from Big Brother. It's like, they were on there once, they did a tiny segment, that segment has grown. Before you know it, they're coming back next week and it's a 10-minute segment. Then they're like a roving reporter. And before you know it, they're basically hosting their own show on BBC One.
But then like, staggering. Someone like Alison from Big Brother who does like, is it This Morning or whatever it is, like, okay, she came from a reality TV route. Like, where did Dom Littlewood come from?
Well, so Alison literally did win a competition to
So that's also, I would say she is brilliant. She is very funny and quite, you know, engaging. And
she can push a man in a river like an absolute pro.
Yeah. Her relationship, I think there's a compilation on YouTube, her relationship of when she ever interviews Hugh Jackman is brilliant. It's really good.
Okay, fair enough. Do enjoy.
But we don't know where Dom Littlewood came from.
We don't know what he is.
We don't know. Okay.
Alan's so vexed by Dom Littlewood, he texts his son Fernando to ask him if he's watching. Fernando doesn't care. And he says, eventually, Fernie didn't reply.
Yes, Fernie, love that.
suggesting he changed his mind and now agreed with me. Of course, that's what that means.
Yeah.
He then goes into a very long tangent about roof insulation, counting sheep, and how hard it is to get to sleep for him.
Yeah, and this, I mean, I can't work out if it's brilliant in the sense of like it's something that Alice, I've got Alison back on the brain.
Alison Partridge.
Yeah,
whether, Alison Clunt.
Yeah, whether Alan would actually do that. So it is a clever piece of, you know, writing, or it's just like a naff segue to get him into the loft. I can't quite work out where I stand on this in terms of getting him into the loft.
And I mean, it's also worth noting we're on page 18 now and we're still no closer to establishing the journey he'll be taking or crucially starting it.
Yeah.
But we know what it's called and how long it will be.
Starts to imagine the problems there would be with fencing sheep into a field. If you're counting sheep, then they're escaping from a locked field and that's a problem for him. And as he says, it's another reason to despise farmers. We know he's got previous there, like Alan Partridge.
Yeah, there's some nice character consistency with bits like that, aren't there?
And then he's finished talking about loft insulation for a minute, so why not 250 words on scratching his bum?
What, clawing at the angry aperture?
Exactly. Scrit, 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 skit, scrit, 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 scrit. And then you'll notice that he misspells one of the instances of scrit when he's written it down, and then he puts that in a footnote saying, I've just realised the fifth scrit was spelt skit. This was my error and I apologise, but I thought, crucially, he's not corrected it. He's chosen to rather write a footnote.
And he replicates that in the audiobook as well, so we could have just changed it then
Nah.
But it's all about adds to the word count, isn't it?
Good point.
Yeah.
Yes, and he's been inspecting his loft, but he put a fat, heavy-duty mag light in his mouth instead of a regular torch, and it stretched his lips painfully, like when the cleaner's not been and there are only serving spoons left. Now, I thought, at this point, Sonia is probably still the cleaner.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Possibly.
I think by this time, he's got a new cleaner that that is undergoing chemotherapy, who we don't think is Sonia, but I think at this point it might still be Sonia cleaning.
We could speculate that it is Sonia.
I'm sure there's a reference about sacking your cleaner or something.
He decides to share his thoughts on roof insulation with the One Show, sending an SMS to 8882 that reads, "My home isn't insulated." Now, I did send that same text to that same number. To my knowledge, it has never been delivered or responded to. So.
But little do you know, they read that out on the One Show yesterday.
Imagine.
Yeah. Good that he acknowledges that he's too late for today's show, but they will probably cover it tomorrow. Before we start today's show, we just need to give you an update on Alan's home. It is insulated.
And as he turns to leave the roof space, he spots the cardboard box that kickstarts this whole journey for a book deal. I mean, meaningful walk. He says there's an otherworldliness to the box that he spots. He hesitates to describe it as an aura because that's a word generally used by women who work in offices and loudly describe themselves as spiritual.
Yeah, he's got no time for anyone of any kind of spiritual nature. A deep cynicism, I would imagine, of anyone that expresses himself in any way to be spiritual.
And he imagines that the voice of the box is quite camp. Hey, Alan, what are you doing? Want to look inside of me? Quite camp, but maybe that's the tinsel. That's right. Tinsel turns boxes camp. That's how this works. So he's not actually investigated the box yet particularly, but the next day he's feeling a good deal better, bright, alert and upbeat, so he doesn't even mind when Simon Denton pipes up and steals his link on Mid-Morning Matters. I assumed Alan would appreciate Simon's wordplay. He says, whereas she was glad it's night, I'm glad it's mid-morning because it means it's time for your call.
I mean, I thought that was great.
Yeah, not a bad gag.
Really
very
good.
But that's probably the whole point, isn't it? That it is good.
Yeah.
Hence, Alan doesn't like it because actually it's competent, it's good, it's funny, it's witty.
And then sets about to belittle Simon through the medium of this book, saying that he happens to know that he grows a full beard to obscure the part of his face that makes him most self-conscious. Footnote, big jowls. So he leaves a few seconds of dead air in which his joke can flap and gasp for death for breath like a stricken fish. And then he also gets him back later by pushing him in a urinal. So he's really
That is so good as well. And the second that was said, my mind just immediately jumped to Alan Partridge, like literally pushing Tim Key into a urinal. Like, it brilliant. Loved it.
This so is what you did is you read the words and then you imagined it in your mind. Yeah, which is kind of how reading a book works.
Mind blown.
What happened was I went to my mind and then it projected an image inside my mind of that very thing happening, and I liked what I saw.
Wow. By that point, you've seen everything.
But I don't like it. I don't like it one bit. Also,
the pushing Simon at a urinal, I think that comes back later as well.
Yes,
yeah, it does. It's an absolute schoolboy thing to do. Brilliant.
Their phone-in is what forms of evil should be added to the list of the seven deadly sins. Alan's suggestions of bad hygiene and using rising inflection at the end of a sentence when you're not even asking a question.
I knew that you're going to do that.
Quick question to the group. What else do you think should be added to the list of evil? I've got being proud of being stupid and starting to type a message so the other person can see and then never finishing.
Very good. I would go for excessively loud chewing of food.
I would go for... Get a reminder of the question?
Eighth deadly sin.
Have we had greed?
Struggling with this imagination thing now, aren't we?
I need to project it into my mind. What have you got?
Perhaps farting in the same room whilst a podcast is being recorded.
Have you just done that?
No, but other people have it previously.
Okay, fine. I'm just going to say meanness.
It's good radio.
I'm glad we waited for that, by the way.
It's good radio, and I feel good that it's good, he says. There's also, he says, solid answers that come in, according to Alan. Clumsiness, vegetarianism, and the sheer indecisiveness of bisexuality.
These are solid answers as well. Yeah, they really are solid answers.
But then he claims the topic's been co-opted by chauvinistic tradesmen who call during their lunch breaks, and they start naming things they hate about women. Shrillness, watching Hollyoaks, taking too long at a cash machine, which are all things I do regularly.
Yeah. Also, it doesn't need to mention that, but he does include it and calls them out because probably deep down he agrees with it.
Yes, absolutely that. He says that he deliberately puts on a bad record, Fairground by Simply Red. So a question to the group, is Fairground objectively a bad piece of music?
Whoa there, Alan.
Absolute banger.
I think it's a banger.
Oh, God. I absolutely hate it. And
really?
I'm so with Alan.
Really?
I am shocked and surprised because your music taste is normally quite questionable.
Well, my memories growing up were that my mum loved Simply Red and she would play this record relentlessly.
Because it's great.
I genuinely can't stand that song.
So you hate it because it reminds you of your mother.
No.
Interesting.
That's what I'm genuinely hateful to women.
Adam, what do you think?
I think it's a high watermark for Simply Red. Take that as you will. A couple of facts about Fairground. The video was filmed at Blackpool Pleasure Beach, mostly shot on the Pepsi Max Big One. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It was Simply Red's only number one hit with 783,000 sales.
Massive.
Yeah.
And Alan describes it as an awful piece of music that I sometimes put on when I want to annoy my own listeners.
I'm staggered because that is, I would say that Fairground by Simply Red or Simply Red in general would be very much brand Partridge.
Well, he had Mick Hucknall on the Christmas Know Me, Know Yule, didn't he?
Mick Hucknall.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously where the joke lies, that Coogan is genuinely friends of Hucknall. So that's, I think we've kind of discussed this thing before, where Partridge will slag off people that Coogan actually is friends with.
Yeah, yeah. And Mick Hucknall wanted to bang one of the extras, wasn't he?
Yeah. Probably allegedly. All of them.
Also, I mean, it is possible in the APU that he had Hucknall on the programme and then there was some sort of perceived yes. slight where perhaps he had some of Alan's hummus or something and now he hates Simply Red.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's a nice dig at Pizza Hut here. One of the corporate goons at the radio station said, loving the Deadly Sins chat, Alan, but Pizza Hut have asked if you could paint gluttony in a more positive light as it's central to their business model and they are an advertiser. Oh, absolutely brilliant. Yes, and then he lurches into the toilets where he finds a colleague, don't know his first name, Rogers, filling the kettle from the wash basin. He insists it tastes better than the tap in the kitchen, which does sometimes taste of chicken, but speaking personally, it would have to taste a lot better for me to want to stand patiently by a tap while 2 yards away men are defecating.
Disgusting. Can we talk briefly about the tap in the kitchenette sometimes tasting of chicken? So that, I believe, links back to Mid-Morning Matters Series 1, where he's saying the tea tastes of chicken, and they have to remind him that
he's just eating
chicken.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, so it's that again.
Yeah. Nice.
It's that again. He's constantly eating chicken, basically. That's the problem, snacking on beak.
I like the conceit that, you know, that happened once, and he's forgotten what the reason was.
Yes, brilliant. The mag light that he was holding in his mouth when he was up in the loft has stretched his mouth. This is a bit weird.
My poor, lovely mouth.
Modern mag lights are only 2.25 inches across, so no longer big enough to stretch a mouth. Perhaps because he wrote a letter, I don't know. I also thought, why isn't he using a Danco nightstick? Surely he's got plenty spare.
Yeah, true. Good point. Possibly the most unnecessary line, the mouth that once suckled at my mother's teat and that first kissed Carol. There's just no need to mention that, is there? No,
absolutely not.
Certainly not the first part.
But it is important to mention that he's brand ambassador for Corsadol mouthwash for the whole of Anglia, not just East. And it's a contractual stipulation that he maintains a healthy mouth. I thought if Alan, this is basically a hygiene slip, which in Alan's book is about as bad as it gets.
Yeah.
I like the contractual stipulations that he has for this partnership, as detailed in the footnote. As well as tweet daily about mouths, mouthwash, gums, brackets fresh, breath, and great taste of Corsadil, and don't slag off Corsadil.
Oh, God.
He says that he avoids opening boxes. He's back in the loft now. He avoids opening boxes he doesn't recognise ever since the time looking for printer paper, where he found what he thought was a brown paper bag of humbugs, only to discover they were dead wasps in a dormant nest. But did I realise that before eating one? Footnote, yes, I did, which I appreciate makes the story a bit less interesting. I mean, also, why would you just eat an old humbug you found in a loft?
Well, there's a couple of things throughout this book that he references that he considers eating, which we'll come on to later, including the sweat that builds up on his body. The black dough. It's like, I'm thinking about eating it. Why?
There's a whole page here where I think a very basic gag has been elevated very well, where someone warns him.
That's the book, isn't it?
I mean, effectively, yeah. Great. Yeah, basic gags elevated excellently. Where someone says, careful, that box contains anthrax, and lo and behold, it's a joke because it's the band Anthrax. Yeah. It's a box of CDs. Again, disproportionate comeback from Alan, much like when Simon ruins his link and he pushes him in front of a urinal. He decides to play a practical joke on the Anthrax joke man, Mr. Gibson, by having his assistant phone him during one of his shows to tell him his elderly mother had a fall. He was all over the place.
Alan prefaces that with, I got into the spirit. No, Alan, you've misjudged this massively.
Yeah, and you've got your assistant to do it. You haven't done anything. You've just briefed your assistant to phone up and deliver that awful news.
Eamon Holmes gets a dig in here. He's basically Alan's looking at the box and desperately trying to tie the narrative strands together to give it more meaning than it really has. He says, I'm here with baggy. I'm looking at bits and bobs that once belonged to my father. I'm here with baggy lips that resemble my father, looking at the personal effects of that father. Well, the first and third points there are the same thing. So bits and bobs that belong to his father and looking at personal effects of his father, that's the same.
Yeah.
You have to admit that's a staggering coincidence. No, you don't. But he says this whole bit seems conveniently neat, according to Eamon Holmes, or a confused mess, my publisher, or a blatant attempt to drum up poignancy, my publisher. So those people, I say, are you calling me a liar? And there'll be those who say yes, actually. So he's off arguing with an imaginary person again.
Yeah, I love it.
And to this I say, lawyer up, footnote, get a solicitor.
And I think we can actually agree it's all of those things, isn't it, that he's been criticised for?
Yeah, absolutely. He then has a flashback to the 20th of February 1995, pre-I'm Alan Partridge Series 1, which was in 97. He's basically watching his dad's casket being put into the ground, but he does then slag him off by saying that basically he's careless with his money and he tried to buy a new sofa every 2 years.
Quick, did it say 20th of February in the book?
Yeah, 20th yes. of February, 1995.
Okay, no, got it.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. That's the funeral. Yeah, he died on the 15th. So it's probably time for a very brief topical quiz, the Alan's Dead Dad Quiz.
Yay!
Okay, let's find it. Here we go. So we learn that Alan's father passed away in February 1995, but can you tell me which of these events, some of them Alan relevant, did happen in that same month and which did not? Please try to answer as a group. Number one, did this happen in February 1995 or not? Riverdance opens in Dublin for the first time.
Ooh, I'd go yes.
Yeah, I think that's around the right time, I think.
I reckon it was...
Do you think earlier?
Are we basically... Is it a sort of yes or no?
It's yes or no as a group.
And you want a group consensus. Okay. We're both saying
I'm
yes,
saying so no, it's... but you've won. Okay. So it's yes.
Correct.
Listen to us.
The first ever clamshell flip phone goes on sale.
Earlier.
Earlier than 95?
No.
Later.
Really?
Yeah, later. Okay. Yeah, all right. It's later.
Later. We're going later.
That's correct. It was 96. Oh, Producer Jed got the year right. Tupac is sentenced to 4.5 years in prison, brackets sexual assault.
Looking at
just a fun quiz.
Looking at a hip-hop man, Tom Dark.
I'm going to go later.
Trust you?
Yep, go with Tom.
Incorrect. It was February 95.
I know nothing.
Electrical goods retailer Rumbelows closes down.
R.I.P. In 95, Rumbelows.
Yeah, I reckon
it's early.
I mean, I know about Foster's Menswear. I don't know about Rumbelows.
Rumbelows definitely existed in 1991 because they sponsored the League Cup that Sheffield Wednesday won. That
wow. I think that was the start of their demise. They put too much money into it. I think it was earlier.
Okay.
Tom, agreeing with that or not?
Yeah, I agree.
Earlier.
Incorrect. It was 95. Reef released their debut album, Replenish.
Ooh.
So you're looking for February 95?
February 95.
Put your hands up was 97, wasn't it, I think? So 95. Okay,
Jed is saying
yeah, we're going 95. With Jed for we'll once. Go with Jed.
Well, it was 95, but it wasn't February, it was June. So bad luck. Former One Direction star Harry Styles was born.
Ooh.
I mean, that could be true.
I reckon 95, so how old would he be now?
He'd be...
20...
He'd be battered.
24? No, older than that.
Going to have to push you for an
this
answer.
This is simple arithmetic.
I'll go yes.
Now.
Yeah, but I'm
yes.
Trying...
Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
Okay, yes. Yes. Let's say yes.
24? No. February 94, the year before.
Russian shit.
Linford Christie breaks the indoor 200 metres world record.
Sports expert Stab is the man to answer this.
I reckon he broke it earlier, so no.
Incorrect. 20.25 seconds in February 95. Well done, Linford Christie. Third Rock from the Sun airs its first episode.
Oh, later, surely.
Yeah, I reckon it's a couple of years later.
Later 90s. Yeah,
not so sure, but I've been outvoted.
Correct.
Yeah.
96, that aired. The Danny Boyle film Shallow Grave is released.
Ooh. That sounds about right.
95. No, it's earlier. I'm going to say it's earlier.
Okay.
Okay, we'll go with Nick.
Yep, earlier.
Incorrect.
Never listen to
that. I've got all of them wrong, sir.
Yeah.
And finally, on the Alan's Dead Dad quiz, it's ruled that new domestic electrical appliances must be supplied with an appropriately fused pre-wired plug. Did that happen in February 95 or not?
I want to say yes.
I've got them all wrong.
I'm going to go with yes.
We're saying yes.
Correct.
End on a high.
There we go. Thanks for taking part in the Alan's Dead Dad quiz.
A really good quiz.
Back to the book. So he's still trying to inject poignancy into this. He says he's a blur of activity. He's sellotaping maps, letters, receipts, and diary pages to the slanting walls of the loft, etc., etc. He takes a further step back, forgetting the roof space is now a lattice of twine, a cat's cradle. So, question to the group: are there any other well-known phrases or words that you've always got wrong? I'm happy to start. I very much used to think that bowen was a type of wood used to make an arrow, and therefore it was a bowen arrow.
Oh, that's amazing! Yeah.
Nice. I like that.
Well, is this Alan getting the phrase wrong, or is it a typo on Alan's part, do we think?
I think he's getting it wrong.
I think he's getting it wrong because he's putting it in...
He's putting it in speech marks.
And there are quite a few other instances throughout the book where he gets things wrong like that.
I'm picturing that quite famous It's Always Sunny meme of Charlie... Is his character name Charlie?
Yeah, his character.
Yeah, where he's kind of like in front of all the pictures with the string.
Yeah, yeah, like all the kind of... All the good obsessive detective series.
Yeah.
But yeah, mispronouncing, I can't think of anything, but I recall a friend at school used to think the word remember was pronounced renember. And I've definitely encountered people that seem to pronounce favourite as favourites. They put like an extra R.
Favourite?
Wow.
Favourite, yeah.
That's new.
Who are those?
That's people, idiots.
That's up there with Nezquilk and Draclia. Alan trips backwards into the cat's cradle and he's snared in the twine like a naked man. A great reveal of the fact he's been doing the whole time. Trapped in the web of a giant information spider.
Yeah.
Yep. And he says, the box tells of a journey my father made, an important journey, a journey of hope to secure a better future for him and his family. A journey from Norwich to the nuclear power plant at Dungeness for a job interview. And my first thought was, his dad probably drove there, didn't he? So,
yeah.
Oh,
and at this
the walk
point,
is unnecessary.
Yeah, at this point, yeah, it really becomes clear that the origins of the walk are just someone going for a job interview. And that's the genesis of this whole idea. Like, there's nothing of interest already at this point in terms of why he's doing the walk.
So you're saying that it's conveniently neat, a confused mess, or a blatant attempt to drum up poignancy?
It's all of those things.
Yeah. You're very much taking the Eamon Holmes slash his publisher's attack there.
What I find quite interesting about this is Alan's dad is going for this job in Dungeness, assuming he needs to be based near Dungeness. He's not going to be commuting every single day from Norwich to Dungeness. So is he going to move the family or is he actually just trying to
start
work
new
out
life.
An exit strategy? Because we learn that he's not actually a particularly nice man.
Yeah.
Although that's Alan's viewpoint of it.
I feel like if I had Alan as a son, I'd probably be trying to beat your retreat. Yeah. I'm skipping forward a little bit, but he says about his dad, he became a hard man to be around, and you'll remember in my autobiography I wrote some hard hitting things about him that worked well in the tough upbringing section.
Love that.
Could professional disappointment have been what made him so bitter, like it did with BT Sports Ray Stubbs? Very specific, nice little dig. I had a little look at Ray Stubbs' Wikipedia and I just wanted to read pretty much without comment the charity work section.
Okay.
Now I don't want to be mean. I don't want to be mean. I don't want to be mean, but I was in stitches and this was not written as a comedy. Okay. Stubbs has been a big supporter of Sport Relief and has become the project's action hero. In 2002, he was dropped 100 feet into a pile of boxes. In 2004, he was suspended from a crane and swung into a giant ball of dung. And in 2006, was tied to a post and bombarded by 15,000 bouncy balls.
This has to be on YouTube, surely.
Is this all genuine?
We're not done yet. In 2007, Stubbs took part in Comic Relief Does Fame Academy and made it to the last five before being struck down by an upper respiratory tract infection. Despite his illness, he still performed twice on the night before being voted out by three of his fellow students so he could go home and recover.
Must excellent.
Oh my goodness. I mean, you know... through the laughter, congratulations to Ray Stubbs for some admirable charity work. That's what I'm saying about that. We're almost at the end of chapter two. He says, Alan's sort of forming an idea of how this project's going to go. Now I know what I must do. I must complete the journey that my father never could, and I must do it on foot, brackets, can't remember why.
Absolutely brilliant.
It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. Let's not forget that a whole chapter ago, he already mentioned that it was called Footsteps of My Father Walk. And then he says, he hears someone shouting his name. He realizes it's his assistant shouting. She sounds panicky because I've ignored the doorbell. She's a ridiculous woman. Every time I don't answer the door because I'm toweling off or thinking or grumpy, she assumes the worst. Just because, bombshell alert, her former friend, a retired policeman, was found dead at home, she assumes we're all going to succumb to a stroke. So RIP Gordon.
Yeah.
Now I think that is referenced in Alpha Papa, but I'm not sure whether they actually name him by character, but I'm sure there is a thing about the kind of Lynn being on edge or something like that.
I must complete the journey that my father never could. I must do it on foot. Can't remember why. It will be called The Footsteps of My Father Walk. My home isn't insulated.
Monkey tennis?
Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. Quite simply, cows.
Monkey tennis?
With his stupid Ewok head.
Blob on him, Nosey.
Love you, Aim.
Monkey tennis?
The total wazzock of a guy. Infinity, the final frontier.
Monkey tennis?
We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols.
Monkey tennis?
Motherfucker. Gary Wilmot. Okay. Sue Cook. Okay.
Dale Winton.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.